Hello everybody, and welcome to the 18th episode of Film Club with Casper. I'm Casper Salmon, and today with me to talk about Carl Theodore Dreyer's 1928 film, The Passion of Joan of Arc, I have the actor Ella Smith. Hi Ella.
Hello, hi, thanks for having me, Casper.
Thank you for coming on so much. I know you from Ray and Liz, but do you want to go through your, go through your credits? What few?
Oh my God, never ask actors to do that because they either immediately apologise or they start lying. But I've been, for people who don't know who I am, I've been a sort of jobbing character slash eventually leading actress for 15 years since leaving drama school.
Starting, I know, theater, from various shows and things.
Lots at the National. And then sort of gradually figured out what a good script was, but that took me about 10 years. And currently filming on an HBO series called The Nevers, which comes out in April.
Oh yeah, get you. Interesting. That's very exciting.
Yeah, so that is that's where I'm at right now.
I was just saying before we started recording, I think Ray and Liz is just one of the best British films of the last, decade. Just such a special film. So I'm really happy to have you on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, it was definitely special to make, to watch, to all of it, to watch its reaction in the film community and to see Richard, it was his first film, to see him sort of be able to take his story to the world.
Yeah.
It was really quite special, really quite moving. I was very happy to be a part of it.
Fantastic. And so this was your pick pretty much today, the film that we're talking about, Dreyer's Passion of Joan of Arc. Had that been kind of swimming around for you somewhere?
It had been, because I write alongside acting, and I'm writing a modern Joan of Arc type story. Very different subject matter, because it's all about a woman trying to tackle incels via intimate relationships, which sounds completely nuts.
Hey, but it sounds great.
In her mind, she's a sort of Joan of Arc, and she sort of gets herself burnt at the stake as well. So it was interesting to me to watch sort of the original story of this, and not just, it was the one of the earliest films ever and that tackled this, probably the first film that tackled Joan of Arc. And also, I knew of it, it's sort of one of those films that you're like, oh God, I should see it, shouldn't I? So then when you actually find yourself sitting down and watching it, it's quite nice because you're like, I got myself there, I'm watching it, here we go.
Yeah. It's that film par excellence, isn't it? Like the film that that's been kind of dragging around, and I fucking know I've got to get round to it at some point. But
yeah, it's like the dry cleaning of films, isn't it? Before you watch it, afterwards you might feel differently, but that's essentially how we came to it.
How did you enjoy it?
I really did enjoy it, but it's not an enjoyable watch.
No.
But I think it leaves you feeling like you had an experience, which, thank God for that, because I think that's what film's supposed to do. And also the context and the timing of how it was made, when it was made, and the medium, of film being the silent era of film and black and white. And it sort of punctuates the story on a deeper level, I think. But it's not an easy watch. It's a very stressful watch because, I don't know if you want to dive into sort of how Dreyer films it, but it's all close-ups. Essentially, you get a few pan shots to sort of establish where we are in the court. And then essentially you're on Falconetti's face for an hour and a half. And it's pretty tragic to watch someone go through that horrendous experience. And very moving, but also not enjoyable at all. But that's a lot of film, isn't it?
Yeah, I totally agree with all of that. I just thought it was an unbelievable film. So intense and full of this extraordinary fervour, and yeah, we'll have to get on to both that sort of crazed almost manner of filming and the extraordinary performance by Falconetti at the heart of this film, which results in something that's just feels kind of hallowed and tortured at once. And as you say, it's it is a harrowing watch.
It's got a weird energy, this film, because I've seen plenty of old films, but it has a, it leaves you feeling unsettled. And I guess it's the difference between, you know, we all know the story of Joan of Arc. So the fact on the page, we can read 100 times, but experiencing it as a lived experience, you know, when you're that close to the face of the actress playing Jeanne, it's the sort of, that's what film triumphs most in terms of depicting, you know, a lived experience, like no other art form really. And so in this version of the story, you cannot escape from feeling every second of the tension and the abuse that she's experiencing. And so it's a different way of knowing a fact, and it's a really horrible way of knowing it. And it's sort of raw, it's raw, isn't it? When you leave the film, you sort of feel a bit dirty and a bit crap. And you don't know you're going to get there until you get there. That's what's interesting too, is that you start the film and you think, okay, because I mean, I'm a cynic like most people, and I start the film and I think, well, God, who are we supposed to care about now? And, you know, and actually by the end of it, you're left feeling utterly hopeless for this young peasant and influence on
the whole country. And all of that comes about because the film delves into her interiority in such a startling way. And it really brings to the fore this kind of dialectic between her body and her soul, the physical manifestation of her and the way it records, you know, her emotions and how open she is in the expression of her feelings. And yet it also describes what is kind of unknowable about her in a way that's really, really startling.
Oh, that's a good way. That's a good way of thinking about it, is that sort of the willingness to feel so openly is actually what's the bravest thing about Joan at this point in time, because she's so convinced that she's hearing voices from God and she has a mission. And actually that's one thing, but to show her feeling on her face more so than any of the other men in the room is a sort of act of bravery. And it's interesting, her performance itself, I don't know what you thought, but you know, this was a youngish theatre actress who was picked. This was one of her first films, but for me it went between real sort of gargoyle acting, commedia dell'arte, sort of big expressions on her face, especially when she's sort of reaching for God in her sadness and her angst. And then a second later, she's sort of doing quite detailed, specific performance, a sort of Meryl Streep hand acting stuff. And and that's so interesting to me, because now, as a modern audience watching that, it smacks to me of someone going in and out of a sort of manic episode. Which is so interesting that was maybe before its time in terms of people knowing what various forms of psychosis, mania, depression were. And so her internal energy sort of shifts as her focus shifts between the court and her God. And so it's really unnerving too to watch that. And I don't know if that was a happy accident, because she's sort of, if I'm an actress and I'm watching what she's doing, because we try and do that, we study what other people do, I think one minute, oh, I get what she's doing. She's showing us emotions, you know. And the next minute I think, I've no idea what she's thinking. She's just being. And that for me is very interesting to watch in a film that was made in 1928. Because I'm like, oh, we're still trying to do that now, you know. So it's interesting. I mean, she's striking to look at too, her face, isn't it? And she's lit differently from the others.
She's sort of lit from within in any case. And then, Drea accords her a real particularity of treatment so that she stands out to an even greater degree. I'm wondering if I should just, for listeners, if I should just go over, I mean, what little story there is. And then we can, if you're willing, carry on talking about her performance, because I think, gosh, there's still a lot to say. So the film essentially takes the form of a trial, doesn't it? And I was interested to see at the start that it's intent in showing how based in fact its depiction of Joan is, because it's based on the court testimonials, the court
the record.
Thank you.
Yeah, the record of the time.
Fucking hell, the court records of her trial. And from that introduction, the film proceeds to her trial, and then the trial takes place, and it essentially consists of a bunch of men trying to extract a confession from her, and she doesn't give in to these entreaties and shows how headstrong and determined she is and how convinced of her rectitude. And from there, they threaten her with torture and manage to extract, by tricking her, a confession from her, whereupon they seek to imprison her, and she then recants that confession before eventually being burned alive. Is that about the long and short of it?
Yeah, that's the whole shebang. I mean, also there's a lot of politics going on behind the story in terms of, you know, she was the whole reason that France had a king, basically. She convinced the Dauphin, go on, go for it, get a coronation, fight back against the English. You can do this. God's telling me, with our strength together, you've got God on your side, you know. And so England, that was doing incredibly well during the Hundred Years' War, was suddenly losing. And fast. And France was regaining its identity. And so, yeah, the behind this story is a lot of politics, but this actual film shows none of the politics, absolutely none of it, which is quite bold, because even then filmmaking was sort of contextually open in terms of telling the stories in terms of that stuff. But because it focuses in on just her experience of being in court and the way it felt for her, you sort of have a guess that people's, the reasons for what they're doing are not sort of, you can see there's something going on behind the scenes, but it's never mentioned in terms of why they're dragging this woman through torture and burning her. And they have gains to be made on their sides, and powerful gains. So it's really crucial for these people that they get a confession. That's why they try so hard. Because it's power, essentially. And this little peasant girl is sort of the thing standing in their way at this point.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, none of that gets mentioned, really. You just get some mentions of the king, a lot of mention of God and the devil. And that's really interesting too, that there was no attempt to explain how she got to where she got to.
How did you feel about the presentation of faith and of God and the devil and the sense of religious calling that might have been driving her? I feel like the film does really sort of get to grips with that question, actually, and we somehow have a sense of what is propelling her, and of the force of her conviction coming from something much greater than these kind of straitened circumstances she finds herself in. I don't know where that comes from.
Yeah, I do feel like the faith is very pure in this film and untouchable. And, you know, there's simple moments where she's really lost her will and she sees the reflection of a window.
Yes, the light.
She sees there's a reflection and the light hits the window and makes a cross on the ground. And it's her reminder of who she is. And it's, you know, she takes these signs from God. She has no reason not to believe in what she believes. And it's really moving. And also the amount of times that you're watching her look up to heaven. I mean, she looks up more than she looks around and more than she looks down and more than she closes her eyes. She's sort of, you know, the image of Christ on the cross looking up.
Yes.
Yeah. there's that. And at one point they're teasing her, the jailers, aren't they? And they've put this crown on her and making her hold, what are they making her hold? Something. And then they're sort of
scepter,
making fun
it?
Of her as a sort of jester.
Weird thing.
Yeah, that's right. But it's actually really, that image is pretty striking because you're seeing something, and actually they're trying to laugh at her, but her power in that image is more than the joke. And it sort of burns through. And I also they're also similarly gargoyled faces of the priests and the men in the court because they're lit so sort of, I don't know, there's a lot of shadows on their faces and I think they were cast beautifully. I mean, beautiful French faces that have all sorts of lines in them and all sorts of the incredulity of the men in the court that this young girl would be so bold as to say, you know, that she has a direct relationship with God, which wasn't her job actually at the time. Only if you were in the church could you have any kind of conversation with God. And so she was bypassing their power. And that for them was really tough. And obviously that the way they make fun of her and the sort of snickers and the looks and every time she answers a question, honestly, you know, it's almost like they're having fun at how far she'll go and what she'll say. But actually, they're having fun. And as a viewer, you're thinking, well, I believe her. She seems to be more open than the rest of the court.
Yeah. Gosh, I want to pick up on so many things that you've mentioned. I think particularly the faces of her detractors and the way they contrast with hers. All of the work that Drea has done in casting, as you rightly say, the whole film is peopled with these quite extraordinary faces, rather baroque visions of people. And that goes right down to the tiniest roles. There's an extraordinary child who pops up later on in the film, weeping over the body of, I think, maybe a grandmother or his mother, when the shit hits the fan after Joan's burning. Just extraordinary visions of people. And those form a really potent contrast for Joan's steadfastness, or Jeanne's rather. And as you say, Drea also kind of, I don't know, he sort of seems to see a kind of trivial busyness and entertainment in what these men are about. And that's heightened by those camera movements, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's so many sort of established, there's so many shots that you recognise in later films. So the shots where you've got a shot from Joan's point of view and at one point it pans across six faces and it's as if you're Joan, right? So it pans across six goading male faces. And that's a shot that we've seen time and time again. I imagine it was one of the first times that was done. And then we've got the establishing sort of dolly shots where we literally move across many, many bodies
he does that right at the start, doesn't he?
And right at the start, and we move across these bodies jostling to get a look at Joan. So it creates that sort of excitement, that sort of, you know, that as much as this figure was so hated by their court that actually they're fascinated by her. And that gives her a lot of power immediately. You know, it's really lovely. But also, I think, I remember when I worked with Danny Boyle a couple of times, and he was talking, he told me one day, just having a cup of tea on set, and he told me about why they shoot close-ups like that on the screen. And he said nowadays it's because people are watching at home on their TVs, and it's sort of like if they're the same size as you, you feel like you're in the room with them. Mm. And I think that's really interesting, because watching this, we've all got big TVs nowadays. We've got slightly bigger TVs, haven't we, than when I was growing up. And I feel like, you know, Joan's face is bigger than mine at this point on film. So it feels like I'm literally right up next to her skin watching this. And I imagine in a cinema, it's similar. It's, you feel like you're sort of whispering in her ear, and then you're suddenly sitting on the shoulder of someone else and someone else. So when you have those close-up shots in that succession, you feel like you're this little sort of mouse jumping on the shoulders of all these characters. So it's sort of impossible to escape them as well. And I know that they built all these expensive sets, and they didn't even bloody use them, did they, really? Apart from the few
establishers. I know, I read that too. It is extraordinary. Mm. And yet you do feel that set in many ways, and the glimpses that you get of it, of the high windows and of of the ramparts in the background at times, those all contribute to the sense of her powerlessness in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's nice, as soon as you do get outside and you see a crowd form when she's about to be, you see the people turn up. And it's this, there's a big difference in the feeling of it because you feel like, oh, these are the normal people of France. And they may be on the same size because they're coming to watch her be burned. But these are real people without any political agenda. These are the French peasants, or the French, I don't know who they are, there's just the people. And and it's fascinating because she has such a deep effect on them. Her honor of letting herself be burnt and not fighting, I mean, she picks up, doesn't the executioner pick up, drop a rope, and she picks it up and gives it to him to help.
She helps him bind her, I think.
And you know, so it's fascinating because you feel responsible for Joan by the end of this as a viewer. And so when finally she's being burnt alive and that person in the crowd cries, "You've burnt a saint," and the other priest holds up a cross for her to look at as she dies, you think, thank God, there's some normality here. Mm. And there's quite a shift in the feeling of the film because, you know, something terrible has happened. Mm. And I thought it lets you feel what you've been trying to feel for about an hour.
Right. Yeah. I think there's something interesting there, actually, because perhaps those normal people take our place in a sense, or you know, we're all spectators, as it were, and we as spectators have recognised something in Joan that these other spectators who've been kind of prepared for some sort of show also see that fervour and recognise something. So I feel like there's something kind of extra going on there, maybe.
And you can tell because Dreyer, as a director, he doesn't just sort of do the bog standard three shots of the crowd and back on Joan. which is something that most films do now, like, oh, let's just cut to the crowd being very cross.
Yeah.
What he does is he finds a couple of faces in the crowd and asks them to weep. And actually, for extras, they're really good actors. So I imagine they were also theatre actors, because it's hard to get an extra to sob on command. You know? But yeah, this is their
they've had a lovely day out and got their hair curled. It's lovely.
Absolutely. Yeah, they've worn some woolen mittens. But in this instance, you've got some beautiful acting from supporting artists, and that he features many, many, many of them. Mm. Young faces, lots of women all of a sudden. We're suddenly allowed to see women's faces that we've been starved of for the whole film, other than Falconetti's face. And And we keep going back to them because I think at that point, what's happening is happening. And it's just about the rollout of that. And people came to watch her be burnt, and it was incredibly moving. And she'd won over the crowd, and she's won you over as an audience member, like you say. And so there's something lovely going on there. And even the children's faces, you know, it's really moving.
It is. And it's interesting, as you say, we've been starved of female characters, and there's something going on with the film's presentation of gender, as there has to be, obviously.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, there's a whole extended sequence where they ask her why she dresses in men's clothes, and also where they're sort of trying to work out how she saw the Lord in her visions. Well, not the Lord, sorry, his messenger. But all of that plays into the film's presentation of gender, and it adds extra layer to the fact that what we're assisting to is really the degradation and debasement of a woman for a long time. And that is really, really hard to watch, I think, perhaps especially with modern eyes, because I suppose we bring much more understanding of gender to our viewing of this film than perhaps would have been commonplace at the time.
We do now, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about why Joan dressed like she dressed as well. And she doesn't want to answer is the honest truth. But also, you know, she was also in a male prison. She was literally put in, there wasn't a female prison, she was put in a male prison. So I mean, I imagine that was about her saving herself a little bit from awful things that happen in prisons. But I think that it's another way of her setting herself apart. And I imagine that, you know, when she was trying to convince the people she had to kind of work through various people to even get an audience with the Dauphin. And it took a lot of guts and charm. And I imagine that the biggest obstacle she had along the way was you're just a girl, you know? And I imagine she figured out pretty early that that wasn't going to work for her, you know, being just a girl. And so she dressed in men's clothes and she cut her hair and she assumed power that way. And by the end, the thing that she assumed as powerful was the thing that was most horrendous to the other men around her. You know, the way she looked was a real problem. And it also, you know, they were calling her a witch as well. And that's how they killed witches, you know, back then. And I think in terms of gender, I mean, she's such an innocent, isn't she? She really is innocent. There's in a way, religion replaces sex in this because her fervor and her frenzy is for God. And you feel that running through her veins. There's a lot of films now that there's a sexual undercurrent, but there's sort of something going on here where her body belongs to God, and that's completely replaced the sex in the film.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I love the idea of her being an innocent, and I think the film is quite weird there, because I know you said that Falconetti was a young actor, but I mean, she clearly is so much older than the character as well. And I think that does bring another dimension to her performance of the role, because I feel like it adds an element of experience.
There's something worldly about her gaze, isn't there?
Yeah. And she feels sort of tired and worn in a way as well. And I think that contributes to it being such a kind of hard watch, is that we're seeing really the toll that this takes on a person who has already suffered.
Seen
a lot.
Absolutely, the heaviness. I mean, from the get-go, the It's very, very slowed down, her face. And it's sort of almost as if it's filmed in slow motion, but it's almost as if Drea said, we haven't got the technology to do slow-mo yet, so can we do very, very slow
mobile
reactions?
Yeah.
You know, as in when she turns a gaze from one man of the court to the next, yeah. It takes her 6 seconds. Yeah. And in that time, as an audience member, you sort of get to feel how you feel, and you get to sort of slung along slowly with her. And I'm sure there's something about, you know, the frame rate there as well, technically I wouldn't know, but but there's something about when you have, you know, I'm sure most people know, when you have the time in film to be allowed to feel what you feel, it's quite challenging for a viewer, because when you're not being distracted by the next part of the story, you're really, it's sort of like therapy, isn't it? Basically, because you're not.
No, I know what you mean exactly, is that you're having to connect so heavily to this experience and dig right down. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, there's no escape. And funnily enough, I mean, not to harp on, but some people said that of Ray and Liz in that regard, in that there was a lot of space in that film, a lot of air, where you're just sitting with people living. Yeah. And I remember I was asked to pass something. I was asked to pass some cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. To someone, I remember.
In a jar. And the director said, you know, and Richard said, you know, really take your time with that. You're looking for ways to fill your day. And it struck me as so different to the life we lead now, the fast paced world we lead, the internet, right. Everything. And there's something about slowing down that you have a religious experience. I think that's what
yes,
I mean.
That's great.
So when the film slows you down, you're made to have a sort of oddly religious experience. Even as an atheist myself, you leave it feeling pretty, you feel something other than the normal feelings you feel in everyday life.
I was really struck by all of those camera shots and the perspective, the way he sets it up. And what I love, especially in his filmmaking, Drea's, is it feels almost... it feels almost unhinged at times, or like there's... some sort of havoc at play. I mean, it doesn't feel like he's working to a kind of textbook of how to make a film. You know, these close-ups that we get of Joan can be from over her shoulder, a little bit of forehead in the corner of the screen, and then swooping right up to these warty magistrates, and also these magistrates who have about, you know, 10 meters of ceiling above them that's occupying up a bit of the screen. And I feel all of that contributes so much to that intensity as well, to that idea of having to concentrate very much on what's happening here. It unsettles us not to know exactly where we are. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're like, if there was a... It's sort of like asking someone to go up and downstairs without a handle a little bit. You just don't, on a boat, you know, you don't know what you can grab. So yes. Really what you're grabbing is this central performance. It's the steadiest thing in it, you know, and it's the most convincing thing. And so she's always the anchor. And so therefore her emotions are always at the forefront.
Yeah,
she's quite clever.
Clever.
You know,
that's a really good point. The other thing I was going to say about this film is that I found the textures in it completely sort of transporting. I mean, heart-stopping almost. There's a shot of a pebbled path outside the court, filmed upside down. Do you know the one I mean?
Yeah.
Filmed upside down, where you really get the sense of these fucking pebbles. And also a shot of her hair being swept up from the floor by some courtier, I guess, some orderly. And it's so beautifully done, this dustpan that's just a board and these clippings swept onto there, and her crown as well. And in those scenes, and also in the kind of the cord of her robe at the end, I don't know, there's just something really beguiling about all of these textures, the feel of the film. I don't know if that...
I wonder if it's... I mean, the one quote I found about that Dreyer said is that I wanted to interpret a hymn to the triumph of the soul over life.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that's something about the flesh being... The flesh and the things you can touch and hold being one thing. Mm. And then belief and spirit and life, inner life, being something else. So that we see the distinction between the things that will no longer be here and the things that will last forever, I wonder. I mean, that's just me bullshitting. But
no, I think that's really good. Because the hair, by the same token as the light that she sees, which brings her a sign from God, the hair being swept up is a signal to her to recant her confession, I think. That's what prompts her to...
Yeah.
Ask for them to ask for the judge to be brought back to her, and
at one point she's very sick.
Oh my gosh, that scene
her as well, which is quite striking.
I mean, I did actually scream.
you'd blocked it out, Casper.
Yeah,
I mean, haven't you?
I did.
It was that horrible.
I mean, it was horrible, and so visceral.
And there's something also about seeing her blood pour out of her into this bowl, you know, and that's obviously what they did then to make people feel better is bleed them, which was so dumb, but that's what they did. And I remember hearing something about how they actually decided that they shouldn't bleed her because a witch's blood, so something going on with a witch's blood that they believed was going to kind of release or something like that. So I think the bleeding, I think there was more to the story than we know in the film about the bleeding of her. But when you see it pour out of her, there's so much of it. It's not just a little bit. It just keeps going, doesn't it? It's spurting.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, it's like, yeah, that's that. There you go. She's a living, breathing person that you're doing this to. And there's the proof of it. There's her blood and it just keeps coming.
Well, anything, you know, like that, that when it happens in an old film that doesn't have any special effects and that, you know, that can barely even... You know, there's no zoom or whatever it might be, is sort of, I just feel it so much more readily if anybody, you know, even if anybody even jumps, I think, bloody hell, there's a bit of action. Here's something, you know, it's just, it jumps out so much more. And I feel like as modern viewers, having those experience go back to their, you know, to their primal sense of what they ought to make us feel is really powerful, you know.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I didn't think actually of the textures really when I was watching the film, but I did keep looking at the arches and the doors and the windows and the curve of them. And he really does, he does float the camera up to those curves more than is necessary.
Yeah.
And It may be because he felt guilty because the set was so expensive. But actually, that's what I would have done. I'm going to keep my producers happy.
God's sake, get a fucking gable in.
Get one of those gables in or you're fired. But I do think there's something about, you know, the curve of the arches, the curve of the woman, you know, that the roundness of that was lovely. And in terms of, you know, when you don't have colour, your eye is looking for something, isn't it? Sort of naturally. I mean, it wasn't back then, but for us as modern viewers, your eye is looking for something to kind of grab us. And most of the time, you know, we keep coming back to Renee's face. And there's something very striking about her face too, because she's obviously very beautiful, but she's very handsomely beautiful, I think. You know, no makeup and no hair to sort of frame her. So you're just looking at her bone structure too, aren't you? It's a really interesting bone structure because it's almost quite a flat, open face, quite a wide jaw at the bottom, and so it's like, for me, her face was a little bit like the moon. Does that make sense? It was sort of like,
I might need a bit more from you on that one.
For me, her face is, you know, because she was always called the sort of, was she called the sparrow or the sort of the little, you know, thing? But actually she's got quite a broad face, I think is what I'm saying, and a handsome face. And there was something, so in a way there was a strength to her face I wasn't expecting from the story I knew. And I thought that was really moving to see her face be, I don't know, I just thought the casting was dead on in terms of, now that's not a face I would have put to Joan of Arc, and I don't know, I was there's a draw of the, I think it's something to do with you're drawn, aren't you, the sea goes to the moon and out again, and I think it was like the draw of her face was like the moon for me. I was like, here I am traveling towards this space again. I don't know how it's happening, but here I am.
But her face is so stark, as you say, and that is of a piece with the set decoration, which I found quite intriguing. And it felt like, Estrella's Danish, right? And it felt like there was a kind of Northern European vibe going on there or something, like, you know, a Scandinavian starkness to the set. Because, I mean, the courts of law and even prisons would have been pretty, not lush, but do you know what I mean? Medieval times.
There would have been more detail, absolutely. Yeah.
And here, everything is bare, and we get really stark wrought iron, at one point a wrought iron chair, I think, against these white walls, which were painted pink so that they would appear, I think, white. They were painted pink at any rate so that they would stand out in the black and white presentation. And
yeah, so like a 1928 IKEA. So very
exactly, beautiful. But it really is that. It really is that stark, though, and that makes us kind of famished, because all of these faces. He also has Antonin Artaud in the film, playing a monk towards the end who talks with Jeanne, and the two of them have faces like cliff edges, and that just makes things, I don't know, it means that you,
he sort of weirdly looked like a kind of sexy Abraham Lincoln.
Yes, very much so, although I find Abraham Lincoln plenty sexy on his own.
fine, we don't need to elaborate on that, and I agree, but he's a sort of young, you know, a young, striking, dark-featured Frenchman, and he's got a softness to Joan from the moment you see him see her, and that it's a developing relationship, which is lovely, because, you know, by the end he's the one, isn't he, who holds up the cross for her as she's burnt, and that's lovely because you see in the short space of time her effect on just one person who's supposed to be against her. And you can see how she was so deeply, her faith and her beliefs so deeply affected other people. And actually, it shows you that someone's steadfast beliefs, whatever you might think of them, they are inspiring as long as you're convinced by them, you know. And so I think that's the point, isn't it? That the soul in Joan is, or it will forever affect people because of what she so passionately and deeply believed. And what's interesting between this about this version of Joan versus, say, the George Bernard Shaw version in the play is, in she's more of a lawyer in that play, you know, she's full of great arguments, and there's lots of back and forth, and she's whip smart, you know. She's a sort of, she uses her words in that play as her weapons, and that's the version of Joan we see.
Did you ever see Anne-Marie Duff in the St. Joan?
I don't think I did, but I should. She's brilliant.
She's fabulous at the National. Really, really wonderful. Mm. But yeah, sorry, carry on.
No, but this Joan is not someone who's there. It's almost sort of like debating's beneath her where she's at spiritually. So she's sort of, even just to get an answer out of her, sort of is painful. It's almost like you're asking her to human. Why should she human? She's of God, you know. So it's a very different depiction of Joan in terms of all the versions that we're shown throughout throughout the art world, you know.
Yeah, and that works so well with the fact that this is a silent film. I mean, she's monosyllabic, but we barely even see that. It's just a sort of a small opening of her lips, and you can see thundering on the other side. And so that means that when we get these insets with her words written on them, those are very stark and powerful as well, because they're sort of statements that we see that feel really potent, I think.
I think so. And there's so many, there are shots where they ask a question of her. And before Drea cuts to her, he will cut to three other members of the court who lean in expectantly.
He really builds up to those responses, doesn't he?
Right. And that means that we're going, hold on, we're all going in here for an answer. Yeah. You know, it's not just him, it's the court too, and then therefore us, and we're waiting, and it's almost as if we're hanging off her every word, you know. And again, that lends power to her, because they don't tend to interrupt her. They ask a question, and then they're all completely fascinated by her, and they are losing their power the more they ask her. And so by the end, you see actually quite a lot of broken men watch her be killed. And or you see some men who started off with deep conviction and lost it along the way, I think. And then you see Joan have more conviction than ever right at the end. Yeah. So that's, I mean, that does its job, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Gosh, sorry, I'm just thinking about the film now and really sort of feeling quite shell-shocked. Sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, and the burning sequence takes bloody ages.
Yeah.
You know, which it probably, I know that I heard that on the day, I mean, actually when Joan of Arc was killed, that they burn her body and then they burnt it several other times to make sure that she was, you know, that every last bit of her was gone. And so they went through the process a few times. So imagine how long that would have taken with a crowd watching. And then they threw her ashes in the river, you know, because they didn't want to give her a burial. So brutal, brutal thing. Yeah.
What I was thinking of a little bit while watching it, and don't laugh, is the fucking Mel Gibson film about Jesus.
Do you know that came up because when you Google this film and you say The Passion, then the Mel Gibson film comes up, doesn't it? The Passion of Christ.
Well, he must have been thinking about this film, I think, with that similarity of title and with the fact that I suppose his film is all about an attempt to make physical, but in a much more, I think, barbaric and ugly way, to make physical a kind of religious fervour, and to show that embodiment of a kind of faith. And this film does that too. And I think I'm about to say something very clever here. I think obviously it's a better film than Mel Gibson's.
Who knows? Let's leave it for your listeners to decide. Take a vote.
The end.
Take a poll, yeah. Casper.
But there's a similar process going on, and Drea does dwell on these flames, and we get a real sense of what it would have been to be a body there, and we know that her soul and her convictions are going to carry her through, and yet we really are, because of how extended that sequence is, going through it, and that is so painful.
Yeah, and then because there's nothing you can do as a viewer to stop it, you sort of feel dirty by the end, I think. Because you feel like someone, A, well, you feel like you're a person without convictions of your own, for a start, because how could you have any convictions unless you're Joan of Arc? And then you feel like you're sort of one of those pointless bystanders who said, you're burning a saint, but it's too late, she's burning. So it leaves you utterly depressed. But I mean, it's a film that it won't leave you, because it can't leave you. It's raw, it's relentless, the tension is nonstop. And even if it's the experience of watching it is sort of hard, those images of Joan in court, Joan in handcuffs shuffling along and on the stake definitely pierce into the soul, don't they?
Definitely. I need to start wrapping up here, I think, but if you have any concluding comments or anything that you feel like we haven't touched on, now's the time.
I have nothing. I've just really enjoyed marvelling at this this film with you. It's been great.
So have I. Yeah, we should do this again.
yeah, absolutely. We'll do Mel Gibson next.
Oh, perfect. Exactly. We'll just go through every Passion film.
Yeah, we'll just stick to the religious ones where people get burnt.
There should be
only several hundred of them.
It should be a separate podcast, you know, like the two atheists wrangling with faith films.
Why not? Let's go there and let's deal with every faith, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, gosh, of course. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Such a joy. Thanks.